Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. What a week. Holy moly. I mean, this has to be, the week before last, it kind of toned down just a little bit. I was actually able to have the time to bring you, like, the second installment of what high tech is doing to your privacy, likely to do to your elections, certainly doing to your freedoms. And this week, wow, holy smokes, things, the lid blew off. And, you know, I'm going to be talking a little bit this morning about some of the things that you've heard about, the IG referral on McCabe, the congressional criminal referrals, and a whole bunch of bad actors. I'm going to be telling you a little bit behind the scenes that you're not really hearing in the media. In fact, some media, believe it or not, some media is not even covering this yet. Unbelievable how far journalism has fallen. And we're also going to be talking, there were a slew of things that happened this week that nobody, as usual, is talking about, and which I'm going to, as usual, bring to you. And they are big things having to do with China and having to do with some lawsuits that have been filed. You know, there's not just the DNC lawsuit on Russian collusion. I mean, it's really unbelievable. But there was another lawsuit filed against Hillary Clinton and over 1,000 mucky mucks from Hollywood. And it's $84 million in election fraud. Pretty interesting. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. We're going to be talking about reparations. You know, I got some great emails, some questions from listeners. I'm not going to read them, but I am going to go over them briefly for you. And I'm going to answer all those in this show. So I'm going to go over those in just a little bit. And one of them has to do with reparations. I mean, I got several emails from people who are just incredulous. Oh, that can't happen here and da-da-da. Wait till I share with you this morning what has happened just in the last week around reparations in the United States of America. I was the first, in fact, I may be the only one yet, to be talking about this as a plank in the platform of the Democratic Communist Progressive Party. Yeah, your eyeballs will roll. And it's right here, folks. This isn't Zimbabwe, it isn't Rhodesia, it isn't South Africa. Also, the lid was blown off this whole, I was one of the first to bring it to you, and I've given you little updates here and then. You know, remember Debbie Wasserman Schultz and how she was sheltering this family of Pakistanis? I think like four of the six of them never even worked for the Congress. They got paid $5 million. The IG found out that they were accessing this information. Well, you know what's come out now? Oh, yeah. All the confidential information, top secret information. I mean, we're talking top secret information, including from the Intelligence Committee, was put on a USB and it was given, oh yes, to Pakistani secret police and intelligence. Okay. And what's being done to prosecute these people will set your hair on fire. You know, every week, unfortunately, I bring you stories, or you hear stories, and I recap them for you, about just how far the FBI has fallen under the crooks that ran it. The top crook being Barry, and then Loretta, and then Comey, and then McCabe, and then Baker, and then Strzok, and then Page, and then Straczynski, and then the whole nine yards. The rotten cabal at the FBI. And by the way, you had the same kind of cabal going at the State Department, and the same kind of cabal going at the CIA, and the same kind of cabal going at the DOJ. I mean, Obama did a masterful job. You know, the show before last, I believe it was, when I told you that all these things, and these are just some of them, that Obama did or did not do were they were intentional poison pills placed into the American system to cause failure and disruption. And what we see now is the festering of those poison pills. But I have some things I'm going to share with you there you haven't heard anywhere else either. And then we're going to wrap up the show with my, probably not my final, because I'll be bringing you updates all the way along here. It's so critical to us. But my final, shall we say, specified segment on what high tech is doing to your privacy, to your lives, to your minds, to your perceptions, to your quote-unquote democracy, and to the information it allows you to see or allows you to find. And it's gotten way worse. Just in the last week, we now have AOL. Yeah, the old dinosaur, AOL. In fact, my email is still AOL, I'm ashamed to admit, but it's too difficult to change. So AOL and Verizon and Yahoo and Google Chrome. I'm going to tell you some things about that. Did you know Google Chrome? I'll just give you a taste. Google Chrome, we have found out now, has been uncovered in the last week that Google Chrome, folks, is not only kind of watching, as you already knew, and has been really coming to light here over the last month or two. Google Chrome is not just watching where you go and what your cookies are and all this kind of stuff, and whether you look at a bedspread on site XYZ and then suddenly there's pictures of bedspreads popping up from all over the web. Oh no, Google Chrome, it seems, in their new user agreements, which by the way you're automatically signed up to when you sign up to Google Chrome, they are reading everything in your computer. Let me repeat that. Everything in your computer, your pictures, your travel, your emails, the whole nine yards, and they are storing them. How's that for scary? All right. Well, and of course we're going to start off with a story tonight. A story this morning, excuse me. It's always dark. It always confuses me. You know, I'm a cowboy. I'm easily confused. And this story, like the other stories I try and bring you, weaves right into what we're going to be talking about this morning. And it's really kind of two stories. And it has to do with very, very early American history. In fact, before there was an America. You could call it North American history, so to speak. So first of all, you know, we have a guy by the name of Verrazano. And Verrazano, let's see, what was the exact year? 1524, the year 1524. So Giovanni da Verrazano, 39 years old, Commodore in the Portuguese Navy. And he sails into what is now New York Harbor. And, you know, he was all excited because he figured this was furs and gold and silver and riches. And he was a little disappointed. You know, there were some Indians and there were trees and there were, like, seashores. And, you know, there just wasn't any of the good stuff that he was expecting. So he kind of kept his mouth shut. Didn't say much about it. Sailed on back to Portugal and said, you know, it has some promise, but forget the spices, forget the gold, forget the silver, yada, yada. Well, 85 years later, a gentleman by the name of Henry Hudson, he gets to the same spot, now New York Harbor, and although he, by the way, he was eventually set adrift on an iceberg by a mutinous crew, but that's yet another tale. But he realized that he had come all this way, and he's going to make the best of it. And he decided that he would sail back to England, and he would trumpet the fact that there was this brave new world, and, you know, although he hadn't found any silver or gold or spices, there was all sorts of other great stuff going on, and there probably were gold and silver and spices somewhere, and he needed more ships and more men, and he needed to go back there. Well, let me tell you that Henry Hudson, of course, had a Hudson River named after him. And he had Hudson Bay named after him. He had all sorts of things named after him because Henry Hudson, used publicity to kind of trump himself up. No pun intended on the trump up, by the way. And Verrazano, who kind of wanted to keep it quiet, that poor guy, the only thing he got named for him, and this was like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, was a bridge, the Verrazano Bridge. So there's a little lesson in that. But I'm not done. I'm not done with this story yet. So in 1536, this is a few years after Verrazano and still before Hudson, there was an enterprising captain. And this was 44 years, by the way, after Columbus, just to kind of give you a time perspective. And, 24 years, whatever it was, after Verrazano. So this guy, he was over in England, and his name was Richard Hoare, Sir Richard Hoare, H-O-A-R, or it's sometimes spelled H-O-R-E. He decided that, wow, this place sounded so cool and so remote and so heathen and so primitive that it was kind of like a Jurassic Park, you know, a Jurassic Park of the 1500s. And he thought, what a great tourist deal. You know, Elon Musk would be jealous, right? They're selling space trips. This guy sold trips on two ships to folks who wanted to go over and see this kind of new Jurassic Park that had been discovered there in the 1500s. And he charged them an arm and a leg. One of the ships, not the one he commanded, the second one, that was kind of where he put all the rich dudes, you know, the princes and the dukes and the whatevers. And he loaded that ship up with all sorts of succulent foods and wine and all sorts of yummies for their royal highnesses. And then his ship was kind of the middle class, shall we say, the middle class tourists. And they had a much more Spartan, but nonetheless rather comfy existence as they sailed across the Atlantic. Well, anyway, you know, they wound up somehow, because he misnavigated, on the coast of Nova Scotia. Yeah, well, the 25 well-to-do young men that were in the second ship, and of course their servants, they all had servants, it seems that when they hit shore, they were all out of food and they were all out of wine. They must have had quite a little frat party there going across the ocean. His ship, of course, had some, because he was the captain, he knew what was going on. His ship still had some stores and provisions, but not enough to feed both crews. So to make a long story short, they go out in foraging expeditions. Well, you can imagine how the rich little dukes from England and their servants, who were used to chasing foxes in red tunics, tally-ho, tally-ho, you can imagine how well they did foraging for food in the Jurassic Park. They didn't do well at all. And pretty soon, the whole little band was starving. And there was there were two passengers. One's name was Percy, and one's name was Throckmorton. They decided that they would go out. They seemed to be the best of the foragers, even though everybody was terrible. And Throckmorton decided that he and Percy ought to go out on a long forage together. And, of course, the rest of the crew and the people and the dukes and the commoners that had come over to see Jurassic Park of the 1500s, they all cheered and went, oh, that's great. Well, you know, a few days goes by, nothing happens, and another few days, nothing happens. And finally, after about 2 weeks, here comes Throckmorton. And according to Throckmorton, he hadn't found a thing. And also, he said Percy had somehow become separated from him, and he hadn't seen him again. Well, it seems that Throckmorton appeared well-fed, shall we say. You know, the only thing he didn't have was a toothpick in his teeth. And soon, everybody kind of started taking everybody else out for long forages. And invariably, only one of them was coming back, and he was a rather well-fed forager for somebody who had found no forage. In fact, the situation became so alarming that Captain Hoare gathered them together about 6-8 weeks later and gave them a sermon on the evils, on the devilment of cannibalism. Anyway, about a month later, an unfortunate friendship came in. And, of course, the starving Englishman overpowered the Frenchman and sailed back to England. And, by the way, that was the last, shall we say, Jurassic Park expedition to the New World that we know of. Now, the moral of these stories are, be careful of the publicity you wish for, because sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. And also, it appears that when people get in desperate straits, they eat their own. You know, there's nothing wrong when you are starving, apparently, to eating your shipmate. Well, I think that we will see during the course of this show that Captain Whore's group has nothing on what's happening right now in the deep state as criminal referrals come out and they start throwing each other under the bus. Okay, now, why don't we start off with a whole bunch of, I'm going to give you, shall we say, short stories. Short news blasts that you need to know. And there were too many to mention in my lead up to the show. But California, Dateline California. Not only are cities and counties bailing on the California immigration law, San Diego being the latest this past week, now there's another town going, now there's another county that's going to vote on it. I mean, California has an insurrection going within California's insurrection. But now there is a gentleman, and his name is, and by the way, he's a billionaire, venture capitalist, Tim Draper. And he is spearheading what is proving to be a wildly successful petition to break California, or procedure to break California into three states. A southern state, which would be like Los Angeles, etc., a middle state, and then a northern state, which would be the 40 California counties to the north. And the arguments are many. California is too big. These three smaller states would be much more effectively governed and locally governed by people who are tired of being under the thumb of progressives in Sacramento. It would give diversity to the economy, and I can go on and on the list. The really interesting thing about this is that to get it on the ballot, they only needed like 365,880 registered voters to sign a petition. Well, in a very, very short time, they now have over 605,000 signatures. So the splitting of California into three parts is, in fact, highly likely to be on the ballot. And you know what I think? I think it's highly likely to pass. Now, splitting California into three states would also take an act of Congress after the state votes. I'm not so sure there isn't a constitutional way around that. But we're going to leave that for another discussion. The key thing is here, folks, and there was a survey, by the way, in the last week or so. 62 or 63, I may be a percent or two off, of folks in California back Trump's travel ban and want to see more deportations and much tougher security at the border. That's an amazing number. By the way, the progressives came out and said that the only reason those people checked that box on the survey is that they're uneducated. I guess that's a play on the deplorables or the bitter clingers. You know, if you think that you should have stronger borders, you should deport more people, you should get rid of criminal aliens, then obviously you're just uneducated. You know, all us bubbas, we don't know squat, according to the progressives. And 54 or 55% basically thought that California was on the wrong track and needed a significant change. That's an amazing poll for the state of California. But it dies right into the fact that it appears the votes for seceding from the state or breaking the state into three states is actually going to make the ballot. I found that a fascinating story, which, of course, the press is not covering at all. The next quickie for you, Laura Ingraham. You know, I gave you a list of, I think it was 13 of her advertisers that with no guts whatsoever had bailed because that angry little boy, David Hogue, had done his whatever he did and scared all the corporate chieftains, who I think lean progressive anyway. That's a discussion. What was that, the show before last or last show? Just put Laura Ingraham in the search bar and it'll come up. It'll be quite interesting. And by the way, those 13 firms, don't give them any business, folks. Don't do that. But what's happened is Laura Ingraham came back from vacation, and lo and behold, suddenly her ratings are through the roof, better than they have ever been. In fact, let me give you some stats here because they're really rather remarkable. Okay, she averaged 2.69 million viewers each night this last week. Her closest competitor, Lawrence O'Donnell, MSNBC, had 2.6. CNN Tonight, Don Lemon, had 1.29 million. What's really interesting is that her viewership, if you will, is up astronomically in certain areas. Listen to this. It's up like 40% in the 25 to 54 demographic, 30% in the over 65 graphic, and just about 32% in the 54 to 65 band of viewers, if you will. That's amazing. By the way, that 25 to 54 advertisers consider the sweet spot. They're the people who are most prone to advertising and most prone to buy. So what's now begun to happen? Oh, imagine this. Some of the advertisers are deciding, gee, maybe we ought to go back and advertise on Laura Ingraham's. For instance, Ace Hardware, who was one of the first to cave to angry little David Hogue. Here was their statement. Quote, they had incomplete information, and their decision to withdraw from Ingraham's program was hasty. Unquote. Yeah, okay. Whatever. Money does drive the wheel, does it not? Okay. Next quick one. Oil prices. Now, if you remember, in 2017, you know, every January, the first show in January, I give you my prognostications for the year. And if I remember correctly, without going back and checking, my prognostications for the year 2017 were like spot on, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, except for one thing, which I brought to your attention. And I had projected that oil would be rising dramatically to $60 to $80 a barrel by the end of 2017. That projection was made January, the first week of January 2017. And I brought to your attention that your erstwhile cowboy host had been wrong, because oil at that time was like $35 or $40 a barrel. In fact, I have some good friends in the oil industry, and they had been teasing me unmercifully, because I kept telling them, don't worry, your business is going to pick up, oil's going to go through the roof, blah, blah, blah. And they kept saying, you know, you're full of caca. Well, I'm not full of caca anymore, because crude hit just about $70 a barrel here in the last several weeks, and it's hovering, by the way, in that range, 67 to 70. So it is now, although I was a year late, it is now where I projected it would be, even though all the experts, I make quotations around that, the experts said, oh, oil's going down, it's going to be $25 a barrel, and, you know, all this production coming online from the United States, and then OPEC, and, you know, and then the global economy, there's not enough demand, there's all this production, it's going to depress prices. No. What I told you was geopolitical pressures, economic pressures, and the fact that the so-called experts can't seem to get it right when it comes to production or storage, in other words, reserve, would come into play and oil would go up. Well, it just so happens oil has gone up, and some other interesting stats came out, which kind of bears out, although I was a year late, my hypothesis. The year-to-year, over the last year, the change in United States crude oil inventories, that is kind of oil in reserve, how many barrels you have in reserve, how many days of oil and energy you have for the country, it has fallen almost 24% by a quarter. the reserves of oil. Despite the increased production, despite OPEC kind of turning on the tap a little bit, the bottom line is global production of crude oil has fallen short of the Department of Energy's estimates virtually every month for the last 12 months, and global demand for crude oil has consistently exceeded those forecasts. And the result of less supply and more demand is what? Oh, higher prices. You know, I'm just poor old Hayseed in Wyoming. To give you an idea, the DOE, this is your government at work, folks. I wonder how much we spend on that department. They have, on the average, underestimated the production, or overestimated, excuse me, the production of oil per day by about 4.5 million barrels. 4.5 million barrels. That's a lot, folks. That's a lot. And this is by month, excuse me. And they have underestimated the demand for oil by close to 3 million barrels. Now, that's like 7.5 million barrels of oil. That is a chunk of oil. And at the same time, the same study, which was a study of DOE, you know, government stuff, the same study brought to attention something that I did not know, but sure plays into this whole hypothesis. So if you take like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Norway's Statoil, which is a big outfit, France's Total Oil, Holland's Royal Dutch Shell, I mean, you've heard all these names. These are the giants of the oil industry. It seems that they have cut way back on their capital expenditures. In other words, they are spending less and less money looking for and drilling for oil. In 2014, that's when they peaked, they spent almost $160 billion in exploration, development, drilling, all that kind of stuff. That has slipped, despite the fact that the price of oil is going up, to about $80 billion, slightly under, $80 billion in 2017. In other words, these huge giants of the energy industry are spending half of what they were spending just a few years ago to find oil and get it out of the ground. Now, when you get these five big players, and remember, it takes a long time to bring an oil field on. I mean, you don't find it tomorrow, and then on Thursday you're pumping crude, and then on Friday it's through the pipeline, and then on Saturday it's on a ship or in a refinery, and then on Sunday it's in your car. It's not like that at all. It takes a long time to develop this kind of stuff. So this sinking capital investment by these monster oil companies means that the shortages that you're beginning to see right now, the production levels being lower than that projected, is probably going to continue for some time, with the result that oil prices are going to continue, although they will jump up and down, to rise if you drew a trend line on the chart. So, as I told you in the beginning of 2017, I am now telling you in 2018, buckle up, because you're going to be paying a lot more at the pump. By the way, this whole situation is exacerbated by the fact we're probably going to be tightening the screws in Iran, which the experts, quote unquote, think could decrease production by 500 million barrels a day. Venezuela is in a world of hurt. I mean, Venezuela is virtually under. I mean, they're catatonic. And I've brought you stories on what's happening down there in that disaster socialist country. Well, all their oil, and they were a huge supplier of oil, all that oil is just about dried up. I mean, they're down to a couple 100,000 barrels a day. And then, of course, you have the problems with Russia and probably more sanctions on Russia, which is, since Russia is kind of a one-horse show, one-horse cart, when it comes to economy, I mean, their export is energy, then when you slap Russia with sanctions, you are slapping sanctions, first and foremost, on their energy industry, which further cuts world supply. So you got a lot of things adding up right now. And for those of you out on ranches or in rural areas where you have tanks, like we do, may I suggest that you get them filled. Because if you wait, you will probably be paying more for your 300 gallons, 500 gallons, 1,000 gallons, or whatever storage you happen to have. Our next quickie, so to speak, huge international story, nobody covering it. No, no big deal, no big deal. So Erdogan, the Islamist president of Turkey. Remember, Turkey is kind of a key player in NATO. It kind of anchors the eastern flank of NATO, if you will. Erdogan, by the way, is buddy, chummy with Vladimir Putin. Not good news. Erdogan was also buddy, chummy with Barry, our friend Barack Obama. But that was based on their common Islamist ties. And Erdogan, if you remember, and I talked about it over the last several weeks, Erdogan has been attacking the Kurds, who are our staunchest ally and the best fighters in the Middle East, and who have played a key role in helping us eliminate ISIS. And back a year or two, when Obama wasn't doing anything to contain ISIS, and Erdogan, baby, is pounding the hell out of them with his air force. The United States is assisting some of the Kurds, but trying to kind of cozy up to Erdogan, not push him out of NATO, or who knows what's going on in somebody's mind somewhere. They are allowing him to pummel the PPK Kurds, which he calls a terrorist group. Now, the only reason he calls them a terrorist group is because part of the Kurdistan territory, if you will. Remember, they are the largest indigenous people without a country of their own. 160 million of them. This is not a small outfit. And they are fierce fighters. I mean, they've held Iraq at bay for decades and decades and decades, including with Saddam Hussein. They've held everybody at bay. They've held Turkey at bay. They held ISIS at bay. They turned around and counterattacked with ISIS when they were fighting with, 1950s weapons and winning. I mean, they are fierce fighters and very territorial. They are not shy about defending what they believe to be their territory. So Erdogan is kind of kicking butt on part of the Kurds, the PPK, and the United States isn't doing anything. The United States has drawn the line, however, and they are warning Erdogan and kind of defending the other Kurds from Turkish incursions. But the key thing here is that Erdogan has just called like a snap election. And you'll never guess what the election's about. Let me quote. The election would change Turkey from a parliamentary republic into a presidential republic. I've never heard that term before. A presidential republic, granting the leader of the country expansive new powers. Ha! Are you surprised? This was kind of the model of the Muslim Brotherhood when they took over Egypt. So Erdogan, baby, is making a grab for the cookie jar. And his stated intent, by the way, is to change Turkey into an Islamist republic. Where have we heard that before? Oh, yeah, that's right, Iran. Oh, yeah, I knew I had heard that before. Anyway, none of this is good for NATO. All of this is good for Russia. I'm sure Barack Obama is jumping up and down and clapping his hands. And who knows, maybe he'll send him another $150 billion. And, oh, that's right, they already have nukes, so he can't let them continue to develop them. In any event, we need to keep our eyes on this, folks, because this is a major deal. This affects Syria, this affects Russia, this affects the Middle East, this affects our allies, the Kurds. It could affect Iraq, and it will certainly affect what and to the extent we can deal with Iran. So, let me bring this one step further for you. If Erdogan is successful, and he almost certainly will be, in taking his newfound, ruler of the exalted planet status, and then exercising his authority to change the Constitution, which he will, to convert Turkey from a parliamentary republic into an Islamist state like Iran, the next logical thing is what? Oh, yeah, Iran and Turkey linking up. Remember, Turkey already has a whole bunch of nuclear weapons. Okay, just saying, needs watching. And I don't know what the United States has going, but I'm sure glad that Bolton is in there and not Susan Rice. Next quick thing. I got an email. I got several emails from folks, as I was telling you. I got an email from Debbie in Ohio. And just to summarize it, she said that she's been a customer of Wells Fargo for 30 years. They've always treated her well, and she doesn't think they've done anything wrong. And she just doesn't understand my disdain for Wells Fargo and my sounding the alarm over any of the big banks, which, by the way, the government calls SIFIs. And SIFIs are the government slang for the really big banks that are too big to fail. I'll make it really simple here. They are systemically, let me tell you what the acronym stands for, because you know the government always has stuff. Systemically Important Financial Institutions, SIFIs, S-I-F-I-S, whatever. Anyway, Debbie wrote this email saying that she just didn't understand, etc. So Debbie, look, if you want to keep your accounts at Wells Fargo, God bless you. As I have said a million and one times, I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not giving you financial advice. I'm just giving you common sense. You can do with it what you want. And if these banks are too big to fail, which means the government's going to step in, and if the government doesn't have enough money in its FDI insurance funds to pay off your deposits to save the banks, then there's only one pocket left, and that's yours. And your pocket is your deposits. And that's why in 2010 they passed the law that allowed the banks, or the government, in rescuing the banks, to, without notice to you, convert your deposit to capital stock of the bank. Okay, if it's converted to capital stock of the bank, then the capital in the bank gets up to the threshold that they've set for the bank being either solvent or insolvent. But there's another reason in the case of Wells Fargo. I've talked about it in other shows, but more stuff has come to light. In fact, in the last week, our buddies at Wells Fargo got fined $1 billion, let me underline that, $1 billion fine for fraud and criminal activity against their customers. As a couple of examples here, and by the way, all the big banks, the 19 SIFIs, some are better than others. I mean, most don't go to the extent that Wells Fargo do. But Wells Fargo is, kind of takes the cake when it comes to the SIFIs. I mean, of all the banks. So, let's see. Yeah, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, slapped Wells Fargo with a $1 billion fine just in the last week. Quote, customers of WFC, that's Wells Fargo, were subject to identity theft, forgery, and fraud. Some 3.5 million of them, whose names, social security numbers, and emails were used to open deposit and credit accounts without their knowledge, were paid back false fees that they were charged, over $5 million in false fees. Now, that would be bad enough. However, what's also come to light, and they were fined $124 million for that, by the way, but what's also come to light here over the last several months, culminating last week, so they had a scheme, you'll love this. Let's say you had an auto loan with Wells Fargo. Debbie, I don't know if you do or not, you might want to check. So you have an auto loan with Wells Fargo. Now, any bank has the right to slap insurance on its collateral, whether it's your house or your car or whatever, if you don't get it. That's kind of standard. But what Wells Fargo did was, not only did they slap exorbitant insurance, like, you know, if your car would have been $1,000 to normally insure, they slapped you with like a $5,000 policy and, of course, pocketed the $4,000 difference. However, it now happens that 570,000 to 800,000 customers, think about how many people that is, were also slapped with bank insurance, even though they still had insurance on their cars. So the bank went out and said, oh, your car's insured? Well, that's great. We're going to give you more insurance. Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. So we got about 4.5 million customers just in those two rather sordid scams, and there were others. About 4.5 million customers of Wells Fargo who have been, I'll be kind, mistreated? How's that? Mistreated, yes. That's the term that we'll use. Okay. Now we have the last of our little machine gun rat-a-tat-tat of, well, I guess it's not the last. Thank you. Thank you, producer. Yeah, we have three more quick little rat-a-tat-tats for you. Number one, if you can believe it, there's a county in Illinois. I love this story. There's a county in Illinois that has declared them a, declared themselves a sanctuary county. And you're nodding your head going, oh, yeah, well, like, you know, that's old news. All, there's all sorts of sanctuary cities and counties. But no, as Paul Harvey would say, here's the rest of the story. They have declared themselves a sanctuary county for gun owners. I love it. So if you're a gun owner, if you're a Second Amendment believer, if you are loaded with firepower, this county in Illinois welcomes you with open arms and you are sanctuary. Your guns are sanctuary in that county. And they have sworn to not to disobey any state order or any federal order or any order whatsoever that infringes upon the constitutional right of the people to keep and bear arms, the Second Amendment. I kind of like that story. I really do. Next story, China. Now, I have told you for years, you know, the real enemy, yes, Russia's dangerous for its own reasons, but the real enemy, putting aside Iran and North Korea, is China. And in the end, it will be China and the United States squaring off. I mean, that is just, folks, that is just an inescapable fact on the planet Earth. And President Xi, now that he is president for life, remember that just occurred the last few months, he's come right out and said what he wants. He wants China to be the number one military power in the world. He wants China to be the number one geographic power in the world, the number one resource owner and extractor in the world, the number one economy in the world. I mean, he's right up front. You know, China, China first. Yeah. We got Trump's America first, and we got Xi's China first, and the two are going to collide. Well, in the past week, and remember, we have all the stuff going on in the South China Sea and China building the islands down there into well, actually, they were taking submerged atolls and building them up into full-fledged islands, then putting military installations in them and claiming that the South China Sea is theirs. It just so happens the South China Sea is rich in oil. But, you know, I'm sure that's just a coincidence. And America and China have been sparring down there in the South China Sea with the Philippines and Japan and the Koreas and the Vietnams looking on anxiously for about 3 or 4 years. I mean, Barry didn't do much, but Trump is challenging them. He's sending warships through there, et cetera, to try and keep the idea of open seas and non-sovereign territory alive. Well, China, overseen personally by President Xi, by the way, just put on the largest naval military exercise, an exhibition, that China has put on for 600 years. The last time they assembled this amount of naval firepower, obviously in a different day and age, but, you know, apples to apples, was during the Ming Dynasty 600 years ago. So this exercise over the past week, there were 10,000 People's Liberation Army, it's called the PLA, People's Liberation Army airmen, marines, sailors, 48 naval vessels, 76 aircraft, live fire demonstration of their power. And all these drills, it was 3 days, were off the port city of Sanya, which, by the way, is only about 40 miles from Taiwan. So I think they were sending a message to Taiwan also. I mean, you know, never miss the opportunity. Never waste a crisis, shall we say. And let's see, their aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, I'm probably mispronouncing that, excuse me, PLA. It's a refurbished vessel, believe it or not. that they originally purchased from the Ukraine and then turned into a aircraft carrier. By the way, it's tiny compared to any of ours, but it is an aircraft carrier. And they have another one, which is not so tiny and pretty comparable to ours, under construction. I'm sure they stole the plans in one of their technological hackings. Then they had 8 new missile cruisers and destroyers, like brand new. There's 10 more being built. And they have their new 094A strategic subs, each of which are armed with 12 intercontinental ballistic missiles. Not a good thing. By the way, they have a range of 7,400 kilometers. That's kind of a lethal force, shall we say. And they have their 093B attack submarines. In any event, it was quite the show of force. And if you couple this with what Xi has clearly said his goals are over the last 2 months since he became president for life, and the fact that these exercises were conducted within 40 miles of Taiwan, which, of course, China claims to govern, Taiwan vigorously says they don't, and the South China Sea, this was a warning finger that President Xi shook at the world. Not only that, it was a demonstration of China's rapidly growing military presence, military might, and military capability. Much of it, by the way, with American technology they stole. So, we'll keep our eyes on that too, but that's a situation that's been in the making for, I don't know, a century, couple centuries, maybe 1,000 years, I'm not sure how long, but it's going to play out, folks. It is absolutely going to play out. Okay. That's my rapid-fire set of stories that nobody else is talking about whatsoever. So let's get into some of the big stuff, as if the stuff I just went over wasn't big stuff. Why don't we say the big stuff, which you've probably heard dribs and drabs about over the week. Well, number one, the congressional committees made a number of criminal referrals to the Justice Department and to the IG, but pretty much they're saying these people need to be prosecuted. They listed out the various federal statutes, etc., and that included Comey and McCabe and Loretta Lynch, I love that, and Peter Strzok and Linda Page and 3 or 4 other folks, including our buddy Mr. Rosenstein, which, you know, Rosenstein has been so conflicted from the beginning. He should have never taken undertaken the Mueller investigation. And now he's the subject of a criminal referral. This is the guy who supposedly is running the Mueller deal. And this is the guy who's been stonewalling documents from Congress. You know, out of 46,000 documents that have to do directly with these cases, Congress has received 3,000. Of the 1.2 million documents available that the IG has, Rosenstein has released that same number, 3,000. In fact, we just got the Comey memos here in the last several days, which everybody is all abuzz about, and which I told you to begin with. We're going to, number one, seal Comey's fate criminally because he leaked them, and he admitted he leaked them. I mean, it's just unbelievable. They also, when you read them, exonerate Trump, number one, from collusion, and number two, from any obstruction of justice whatsoever. Hell, he talks about in the memos, he tells Comey, and this, remember, Comey wrote these memos, not anybody else. Comey says that Trump told him to continue the investigation, and he wants to know what he uncovers, and if any of his team was playing with fire, i.e. the Russians, then, go get them. There's no way to twist that into obstruction of justice, folks. And remember that these memos, this is really curious, these memos supposedly are what Comey used to get a special prosecution or special counsel, whatever you want to call it, going with Mueller to begin with. So now the memos have come out. I want you to think about this. So the memos flow from this illegal dossier that was paid for under the table illegally by Hillary Clinton from Russian sources through a British agent, a foreign agent, who's not allowed to participate in U.S. elections, that then went to the FBI, that the FBI, via Comey, on January 6th, by the way, there's an interesting date in here. If you go back to previous shows, I told you about the meeting which had come to light between Obama, Strzok, Page, Susan Rice, Comey, etc. on January 5th. On January 5th. And then the very next day, Comey, after getting a call from Clapper, who we know is a liar, Comey goes up to tell the president about the dossier. He never tells the president, as he admits in the memo, and as he admits in his various interviews on his ridiculous book tour. Wow, I mean, whew, unbelievable. He never tells the president that they were paid for by Hillary Clinton. Instead, they're leaked to the press by Clapper, we're pretty sure, we'll find out. And the whole thing now becomes, obviously, Comey went up there so that, number one, the story of him meeting with the president, telling him about this dossier would leak out, thereby kind of giving a foundation to the dossier somehow, because, you know, this is this dossier, and now the president of the United States has been briefed on it. So now suddenly it's fair game, so Clapper leaks it to CNN, and off we go. Not to mention that the dossier is then used to illegally obtain FISA warrants, to illegally obtain transcripts, to illegally unmask 350 names by Susan Powers, the Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, and Susan Rice and Ben Rhodes, which, by the way, is the other shoe that's going to drop. I've told you this for a long time. You know, I was the only media head. Sean Hannity got on board like a month or two after I started jumping up and down. This is over a year ago now, 14, 15 months ago. I told you when this started that in the end, this would become a boomerang. This would become a mousetrap for the folks who set the cheese. And here we are. So we are now at the point where there is no Russian collusion. That's fallen apart. There is no obstruction of justice. That's fallen apart by the FBI director's own secret memos, which he leaked to the New York Times, felony. And you have an investigation by Mueller, which is unconstitutional and illegal in a whole bunch of respects. If you listen to my show last week and the week before, I went over a list of reasons why Mueller's investigation is unconstitutional. And it primarily goes back to Rosenstein, who is a person who does not have the authority other than to act on what Sessions has recused himself on, which was strictly Russian involvement in the campaign. Anything else is in Sessions' purview. Constitutionally, Rosenstein does not have the authority, so all the expansion of powers he's given to Mueller, whose investigation was illegal to begin with, are illegal. You know, it all goes back to the point of beginning in law. I mean, if you have a problem, that problem carries through to everything. I think some of the talking heads on TV call it the fruit of the poisonous tree, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, what we have now are criminal referrals by Congress, and then the next day, I believe it was Thursday, the IG himself comes out and criminally refers McCabe. And that brings us back to the story I started the show with, the story about dog eat dog, or should I say human eat human. Because now, suddenly, McCabe is saying that Comey is lying. And Comey is saying that McCabe is lying. And Lynch is saying that they're both lying. Ah, yes, the rats throwing each other off the sinking ship. One has to love it. And it's going to get far worse. Because when the unmasking stuff comes down, and you have another 10 or 15 criminal targets in the mix, I can't even imagine what kind of finger-pointing is going to be going on. Well, Comey told me to unmask it. No, I didn't. Lynch told you to unmask it. No, I didn't. McCabe did it all on his own. You got to kind of laugh. I mean, there's some poetic justice going on here. If we don't have real justice yet, at least we're beginning to have some poetic justice. Anyway, we will see what happens. And we will see how voracious the self-feeding humans become in the deep state, Democrat, progressive, treasonous quagmire which they themselves, the hole that they themselves have dug. I mean, it's almost unbelievable. And we'll see, by the way, what kind of cojones Sessions has. I mean, now it's for sure. There's one thing that did bother me, I'll bring up, on this referral by the IG. I thought the referral by the IG of criminality against McCabe was terrific. I mean, he referred him for prosecution. Here's what I didn't like, and what didn't seem to fit in with what I think is going on, which is this guy Huber in Utah that was appointed by Sessions and has been working hand-in-hand with the IG, he didn't get the referral. The referral went to the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. And listen, I don't know who the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia is, nor do I know, I'm assuming he's a Trump appointee or Trump allowed him to stay on. But I do know that D.C. is a swamp, and it concerns me that criminal referrals are going from one side of the ping pong table to the other, rather than going out to Utah where you don't have, should we say, swamp creatures screwing with the muck. How's that? Anyway, the other thing that happened, this was a really bad week for the Democrats, the progressives, and the lying left. Really bad week for them. Number one, you had all this stuff come down. Then you had the Comey memos come out, which, to everybody's horror on the left, not only didn't say collusion, not only didn't say obstruction of justice, but actually said just the opposite. No collusion and no obstruction of justice by Trump. And then on top of that, there was a massive lawsuit filed against Hillary Clinton and involving over 1,000 rich folks, elitists from Hollywood. And I brought this story to you. I told you about this campaign violation story. If you put in Hillary Clinton campaign violations, it'll probably come up. I don't remember the title that was in the show. But I'm pretty sure that'll drag it out of the depths of the website on therightsideradio.com. And to make a long story short, Donna Brazile writes about it in her book. You could also type in her name because I talked about it. Hillary Clinton controlled the purse strings of the DNC during the presidential election, which nobody really knew until Donna Brazile, who had been the acting DNC chair when Debbie Wasserman Schultz stepped down. And Hillary Clinton concocted the scheme so that all her rich buddies in Hollywood could give her a lot more money than they were legally allowed to give her. If you remember, Dinesh D'Souza spent 9 months in jail because he overspent his campaign contribution limitations by $20,000 indirectly through somebody else. Well, what you have here is the usual Hillary Clinton criminal enterprise, if you will. You basically have 1,000 of these rich donors, and they can give $10,000 to certain types of campaigns, and they can give $2,700 to other types of campaigns, and you can do it basically in all 50 states. In other words, you can give $2,700 to a senator from Alaska or to the DNC in Alaska, and you can give $10,000 to the governor, and I'm using these as examples, folks, not as hard facts, $10,000 to the governor race in Arkansas. Well, it just so happens that if you take that $2,700 limitation and the $10,000 limitation, and they did it in every single state, a rich donor could actually contribute $400,000 rather than $2,700 or $10,000. Nice little loophole in the law that Hillary figured out. But it gets better, folks. It gets better. Because now we learn that not only did they give the money to the states, and virtually all, every, well, Every one of these 1,000 donors gave a hell of a lot more than $2,700 or $10,000. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars more. Breaking campaign law, because Hillary Clinton then had the states give it to her campaign at the DNC. In fact, you'll love this. To cover it up further, let's say Sally, actress, sent $2,700 and $10,000, her max under various campaign limitations, to the state of Alaska. By the way, this happens to be an example, a true example. And the state of Alaska DNC then sent it to DNC at DNC national headquarters. It just so happens that all this happened in 24 hours. This wasn't like, you know, the money went in and then, you know, a couple months went by and then the state funneled some money up to the national. Nope. All the money that came into every state, into every campaign that was supposedly for that state and that campaign, went to the national DNC a la Hillary's pocket within 24 hours of it going to the state, to the tune of $84 million in illegal campaign contributions. The FEC, the Federal Election Commission, which still unfortunately has some Obama holdovers in it, has refused to do anything about it. So a very aggressive watchdog group has decided that they're going to do something about it. Good for them. And by the way, some of the people who are getting sued in this illegal campaign contribution and who are all lawyering up right now, of course, none of this is being brought to you by the press that I know of anywhere. But Steven Spielberg, Calvin Klein, the CEO of Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg, and the list goes on and on and on and on. Oh, but, you know, Facebook. Oh, that's right, Facebook. Facebook, who gave all their user information for free to Barack Obama because they liked him in 2012, and who now act so horrified that Cambridge Analytics got some data, only 87 million people, from them and paid for it in the Donald Trump election. Yeah, that Facebook. You know, the Facebook where Zuckerman was sitting on a 5-inch cushion to look taller with his ill-fitting suit talking to Congress a week ago, pretending that he didn't know anything. Maybe he and Comey are buddies. Anyway, what this lawsuit has uncovered, this lawsuit filing has uncovered, and Brazil's book uncovered, and she was a pretty courageous whistleblower on that, I must say. But the bottom line is that Hillary Clinton's campaign illegally used state Democratic parties as straw men to literally launder, millions of dollars in a specific campaign, folks, to get around campaign contribution limitations. Quote, after months of review, the FEC has refused to address the Clinton's $84 million money laundering scheme that violated several campaign finance laws. This is Ted Harvey, by the way. And he's the chairman of the outfit that filed the lawsuit, which was just this last Monday. The Clinton machine has escaped accountability for its illegal practices for far too long. This is an unprecedented scheme to circumvent federal campaign finance law. And there's a bunch of other great quotes here, too. So, what's going on with this now is that there's another outfit that's joining the fray. And they're going to also be a plaintiff in the suit, which is the Committee to Defend the President. So obviously there's a lot of politics going on here. But some of the stuff that's been filed with this lawsuit, it's pretty fascinating. You can call it up online. Quote, when the finance records became publicly available, it turned out that while HVF was appearing to transfer money to up to 40 various state parties, the parties were transferring the same figures directly back to the DNC within 24 hours. On the very same day, each of these transfers supposedly occurred, or occasionally the very next day, every single one of the state parties purportedly contributed all of those funds to the DNC. And remember that Brazil talks about the fact that all the monies that went to the DNC were controlled completely, 100%, by Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton's campaign base in Brooklyn. One of the things which is kind of interesting to note is that even if this lawsuit is unable to prove some of the specifics of the federal campaign violations, and trust me, all these hotshots who contributed quite knowingly, who were part of the scheme, part of the money laundering, part of the breach of federal election campaign laws, which the left doesn't care much about laws, if you haven't noticed. All these people are going to say, Hillary Clinton made me do it. So we're going to see some more dog eat dog. Huh? You see how that story ties in? There's going to be like a feeding frenzy here between everybody. So Steven Spielberg's going to say, Hillary made me do it. I didn't know what I was doing. And Hillary's going to say, oh, well, I didn't make him do anything. He knew exactly what I was doing, and it was legal anyway. And by the way, I've deleted all the emails pertaining to it, and I've bleached my server. So this is going to be really interesting, folks. We're going to have a lot of dog-eat-dog going on the left here. A lot of dog-eat-dog. Because one of the things that does not help Steven Spielberg and Sandberg and the rest of the Hollywood clowns that thought they were being so cute by overspending, you know, because they're above the law, you know. You and I, us bubbas, we don't get to do that. We get them put in our 2,700 or we put in our 10,000 and then we're done. Not them, though, because they're special. They're so special. Well, one of the things that's not going to help these guys much is that there is, in the federal statutes, a clause, which is kind of a catch-all. And what that clause basically says is that if you participate knowingly or unknowingly in any scheme to defraud the United States, including breaking its laws, or in the case of campaign finance, spending way more than you're allowed to spend, then you are liable anyway. So there's going to be some scrambling going on, and there's going to be a lot of finger-pointing going on. And somehow I just don't think that the Hollywood folks are going to be doing this again. So there's at least $85 million that the Democrats are not going to have in the next election cycle. That's a good thing. That's a really good thing. The other thing we had going on this week, so the DNC files a lawsuit alleging a 2016 conspiracy by the Trump campaign, Russia and WikiLeaks to sway the election. Now, didn't we just spend 15 months with Robert Mueller, who hates Trump's guts, and his pit bull, unethical Wiseman, who hates Trump's guts, both of whom love Hillary, supported by Clapper, Brennan, Comey, McCabe, you name it, the whole cabal of corrupt, Hillary butt-kissing progressives that have done so much damage to the CIA, the National Security Services, the FBI, and the Justice Department. Haven't we been through this for 15 months? And haven't we concluded, and by we, I mean that includes Robert Mueller, because now he's looking for sex tapes or something, because there's no Russian collusion. How far we have drifted, illegally and unconstitutionally, from the supposed primary mission. So now we have, after all this investigations, like five congressional committees and Senate committees and Mueller and all this kind of stuff, there's no collusion, blah, 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 blah. Now the DNC files a lawsuit, a civil lawsuit. Well, let me make a projection, shall we say, a prognostication, because you know I like to do that. Just as I told you when they started talking about a special counsel 14 months ago on the Trump-Russia collusion, that this would all backfire and they would rue the day they ever started down this path, and that day is here. I'm telling you that the Democrats are going to rue the day they filed this lawsuit. Because discovery, folks, the right to see everybody's documents and take depositions and do all that kind of stuff, it's a two-way street. It's not just one party. It's not like the FISA court. So all the stuff, do you remember that the DNC did not allow the FBI to investigate its servers to make sure Russia had hacked them? Do you remember that Julian Assange has stated unequivocally that he received the information from a non-state actor? You remember Seth Richards, the IT guy, and the guy he worked with just 2 months ago? Do you remember Seth Richards being murdered at 3 in the morning? Remember his buddy being murdered at 3 in the morning? Supposedly robberies, but nothing was taken. Do you remember WikiLeaks putting up a reward, the only time they've ever done that ever, even though it was small, $20,000, for any information leading to information about the death of Seth Richards? I mean, you can put all these dots together, right? And the next story I'm going to bring you up to speed on, which is these Pakistanis who were able to infiltrate all the congressional systems and give the information to Pakistani intelligence with either the aid or at least the cover of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who at that time was the DNC chairman, folks. Yeah, it all ties in. The bottom line is that this suit is going to, they're going to rue the day they filed the suit. Because guess what? The attorneys for Trump and the other defendants, which include, by the way, Manafort and Jared Kushner and, you know, Don Jr. and whatever. What's going to happen is that the Trump legal machine, which has a lot more money than the DNC, they're broke. The Trump legal machine is going to get that server. And they're going to get all the stuff. And a lot of that stuff the DNC has been hiding for more than a year, folks. This is going to be one of the most embarrassing, embarrassing episodes in the chapters of history of any political party in the United States. That will be the end result of this. And not only that, I think that there will be more criminal liabilities that surface for a whole lot more people. You know, John Podesta, who was pretty much the campaign chairman for Hillary Clinton, John Podesta is facing a host of legal problems on his own because he didn't register as a foreign agent, and his brother was making like millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars from the Russians. Gee, so imagine that. And then you have all these congressional Democrats who allowed this guy from Pakistan to steal all this information. And in my opinion, this is a surmise. I don't have any facts other than a whole bunch of dots which connect very nicely around this hypothesis. This IT guy from Pakistan, he is the one who hacked the DNC computers for Seth Richards, who was a Bernie fan and knew Bernie was getting screwed, and gave the information to Seth Richards and or his buddy, both of whom are now dead. And that's how the information got to WikiLeaks. All this stuff's going to come out. There may even be, who knows, there may even be eventual murder charges that come out of this relative to Seth Richards and the other poor guy from the DNC, the other IT guy who was killed. I mean, it's almost unbelievable that the DNC has filed the suit. It's remarkable. And maybe they think that they're going to file the suit and they're going to raise some money real quick from people who are, this is like their last Hail Mary. You know, Mueller couldn't get them and the FBI couldn't get them and the CIA couldn't get them and the Justice Department couldn't get them and the crooked State Department couldn't get them and Hillary couldn't get them and Kerry couldn't get them and Barry couldn't get them and Susan couldn't get them and Samantha couldn't get them. But now we got them because we're going to have this civil suit. So we're going to send money to the DNC. So maybe it's all big money-raising ploy. Maybe the DNC thinks they'll just dismiss the lawsuit in the future. I don't think so. I've told you, I kind of know how Trump's mind works. I really do. And one day I'll tell you why I know. but I do know how his mind works. And now that you have joined the battle, he's not going to go away. This battle is going to be fought to a nasty, for the Democrats, conclusion. They're going to rue the day. They might rue this day more than they rue the day, and I'm sure they do, that they were jumping up and down for a special counsel. So, the other claims in this lawsuit, let's see. Quote, during the 2016 presidential campaign, you're going to love this. I mean, it's unbelievable. During the 2016 presidential campaign, Russia launched an all-out assault on our democracy, and it found a willing and active partner in Donald Trump's campaign. This is from DNC Chairman Tom Perez. We're going to talk about Tom Perez here in reparations, a reparations segment which is going to curl your hair in just a moment. And Perez calls it, quote, an act of unprecedented treachery, unquote. Wow. Okay. The lawsuit says, in 2016, individuals tied to the Kremlin notified the Trump campaign that Russia intended to interfere with our democracy. Through multiple meetings, emails, and other communications, these Russian agents made clear that their government supported Trump and was prepared to use stolen emails and other information to damage his opponent and the Democratic Party. Okay. Good luck on that, folks. This is going to be fun to watch. I think it's going to be fun to watch. Unfortunately, the one bad thing it will do, and I'm sure that's a side benefit of the Democrats, is it's just further distraction to Trump and his team when he has some pretty meaty things that he's dealing with, all left over from Obama, for the good of the nation. But the Democrats don't care about the good of the nation. That is the least of their concerns. The least of their concerns. Which brings us to reparations. And you know, in a way, this kind of ties in with dog eat dog too. Because reparations are really the economic dog eating the other economic dog. It really is. It's kind of economic cannibalism. Where the haves have to give up what they have to the have-nots on some pretext that is not economic, but social justice in nature. Now, I've given you in the previous shows, and I believe the one where I really gave you a lot of background on Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, and the current confiscation of ranches, farms, properties without compensation from anybody who's not black. You don't have to be white. If you're not black, you're going to lose your property in South Africa right now. And the South African government is going to divvy up amongst its cronies, its favorites. Just like happened in Rhodesia, just like happened in Zimbabwe. With rather disastrous effects, both for starvation and their economies, I might add. Now, I got an email, and this is from Marvin. Marvin in Arizona. So, Marvin in Arizona. In a nutshell, he writes, your story on reparations is interesting, but not believable in that it could not happen in the United States because of our Constitution and because, let's see, what else does it say? Oh, and because we are an armed citizens and our system is built on capitalism and private property. Well, Marvin, that's true, except for one thing. Actually, except for several things. Number one, if they take away your guns, you won't be able to defend your property. And if they take away your guns, you won't be able to defend the First Amendment, which is your right to protest their taking of your property. And lastly, the fact that we have a Constitution is great for those of us who believe in it. But for those quote-unquote Americans who believe the Constitution is an outdated old rag, or as Barry would call it, merely a covenant of negative rights, the Constitution has no bearing whatsoever, particularly if they can whittle down or strip the First and Second Amendments. That's exactly what happened in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, and now in South Africa. Number one, they clamped down. Number one, they disarmed the population. Number two, they clamped down on the population's right to protest, particularly a small segment of the population, the landowners. And lastly, that pesky constitution they had, they just changed it. You know, period. End of story. End of game. Game over. Game match set. And now they're taking the dirt. And the only thing the South Africans can do is South Africans, landowners who are outside of South Africa so they don't get arrested, can scream and yell and nobody's listening. And other than that, you're just kind of done. Now, you say it can't happen here in the United States. You know, when I did that show, and I believe if you type in tactics of the progressives or progressive tactics, either one, and I believe it'll pop up. It was 3-4 weeks ago. I gave you a really good history of what happened. You know, who the leaders were, the various factions, how it all came about. In Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, and South Africa, where it's occurring as we speak. And nobody's covering it. I mean, nobody's covering it. This is a huge story. It is a civil rights story, a human rights story, a socialism versus capitalism story. And it's a scary story. But I gave you a number of prominent Americans, including, whether you like them or not, they're prominent, including elected members of Congress. Keith Ellison from Minnesota. Maxine Waters. Who have both said in the last month or two that they would be favorable toward some type of system of reparations. Because, you know, this white privilege has gone on long enough. And we all need to pay. 700,000 lives wasn't enough back there in the 1860s in the Civil War. We all need to pay now for the generations long before us. Never mind the fact that, as I've pointed out, America is not the inventor of slavery. In fact, Africans are. So, let me tell you, Marvin, just how scary this is getting. This is just in the last week. In the last week. An article came out. It was by Elise Schumer. I'm sorry, this particular article came out August 2nd, 2016. There's a website now, believe it or not, and I'm going to see if I can call this up for you folks. There's a website now that is about voluntary reparations. Voluntary reparations. And this website was founded by some black gals. And what they say is, it's not really about reparations, it's kind of voluntary to help people right the wrongs of today. Quote, it's about reparations for things that happened earlier today, or yesterday, or last Thursday. This is all present tense. And what they do is, you can go to this website, and you know, if you're suffering from white privilege guilt, you can give money or you can give a service, you know, fingernails if you're a fingernail person or haircut if you're a barber, to people who go to the site who are black or non-white and say that they need those services or they need that money. Now, that seems kind of benign on the face of it, I suppose. And if you dial up, by the way, reparations, this will come right up. So will this website. One of the things that this gal says is that, quote, we're being bombarded by death and fear, unquote. And I think people are asking themselves, how can I just be a little bit better? So we're moving, this website is kind of, it's a transition from white privilege to white guilt. And I want to emphasize something to you folks, all of you who are listening. This is not a white or black thing to me. It so happens that it's black folks in South Africa who are taking the lands of other non-black folks And you don't have to be white. You can be Hispanic. You're going to lose your land. And it's not about the fact that Maxine Waters is black, and she likes, and so is Keith Ellison, and he likes reparations. It's not about the fact Barack Obama, who is black, whispered, he didn't go so far as to say we should have reparations. He just said, well, you know, we need some social justice, which was code word for, yeah, we need reparations. This is not a black and white thing. This is, all conflict is economic in the end. This is a have and have not thing. If you think for 1 minute that a black man, and there's many, many, many of them, and getting more all the time, and God bless them, and I hope that there's 10 million more of them in our lifetimes, who have raised themselves up by the bootstraps, overcome adversities, and there are, overcome adversities and gone out and made something for himself and his family, and who now own a 200-acre farm in Pennsylvania or a 100-acre horse place in California, if you think that they're going to be immune from reparations, you're flat wrong. Their property is going to get taken like everybody else's. This is about the haves and the have-nots. Maxine Waters could be white, and we could be red. It doesn't matter. Maxine Waters could be red, and we could be black. It doesn't matter. We have what they, quote-unquote they, not black people, but people who don't have, want. And that really is what reparations is. Oh, yeah, they use the guise of social justice and, you know, former indignities and fear and slavery and all that. It has nothing to do with it. Just like they couldn't care less about the DACA folks. They just like the politics. It's not about immigration. It's about votes. Reparations isn't about some type of long overdue equaling of inequality. It's about taking from one person and giving it to the other person. The one person has something and the other person doesn't. That's what it's about. So you have this website and this recent article, which is kind of a transition, shall we say, along the path of reparations. As she says, reparations, quote, is a word that means repair, and I feel like many people feel broken. Okay, sure. How about we all give to inner city schools, and we give the parents of the kids who are going to those inner city schools vouchers so they can choose the school they go to, they get the best possible education to raise themselves up by the bootstraps and be wealthy beyond belief folks themselves. How's that? That would seem to be a little bit better than this course. Now let me give you another thing, Marvin, since you don't think it can happen here. As you know, the UN is not our friend. Not our friend. Here's an article from September 27th, 2016. Do you see how all this is kind of coming to a head at the tail end of the Obama term? And I think we can all agree that Obama was a master at division by gender, by race, by religion, by age, by creed, by income levels, by economic. Do you understand what they're doing? If you take something from a have who is never going to vote for you, and you give it to four or five have-nots who are always going to vote for you, you're buying votes with other people's money, which is in effect what they do every day with our tax dollars, isn't it? A welfare check to many people, not to all, is merely a way to purchase a vote, to create a dependency, and to make sure that you have a reliable electorate in the future. Anyway, there's a UN panel. The United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. Wow, what a lofty title. And it's run by the High Commissioner on Human Rights. Hoo-hoo. And is part of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Basically, their conclusion is that the history in slavery, I'm quoting now, the history of slavery in the United States justifies reparations for African Americans. You can go online and read this for yourself, folks, and Marvin. Please do. It's kind of scary. Let me give you that again. United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. Google it up. Read their report. I quote, in particular, the legacy of colonial history. Let me digress for a moment. Do you remember Barack Obama screaming, yelling, and moaning in his books and on his stump speech about the colonial powers? Do you remember me telling you about how he really supported ISIS because in his mind they were the insurgents rising up against the old colonial powers? Understand where this mentality comes from. Remember Jeremiah Wright's sermons railing against the colonial powers? Do you remember Barry and Mushel sat in the pews there for 20 years? Remember his book, Dreams From My Father? His father, a devout Islamist Marxist. What is Marxism? Oh, yes. That's right. Let's see. What is the exact words? To each what they need from each that they can produce. I mean, I'm bastardizing it. I just butchered it. But you, from each according to their needs. Producer, help me out. Used to know this off the top of my tongue here. From each according to their needs to each according to their wants. Yes, right. Karl Marx. In other words, you take from the haves, you give to the have-nots. So let me continue. The legacy of colonial history, enslavement, racial subordination and segregation, racial terrorism, and racial inequality in the United States remains a serious challenge, as there has been no real commitment. 700,000 lives is not a commitment, folks. There's been no real commitment to reparations and to truth and reconciliation for people of African descent. Contemporary police killings and the trauma that they create are reminiscent of the past racial terror of lynching, unquote. That's the United Nations working for you, folks. This is the same outfit we send $12 billion to. I think Trump's cut it by a third. He needs to cut it to zero. Quote, despite substantial changes since the end of the enforcement of Jim Crow and the fight for civil rights, ideology ensuring the domination of one group over another continues to negatively impact the civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights of African Americans today. The dangerous ideology of white supremacy inhibits social cohesion amongst the United States population. Wow, I didn't realize we were so horrible here. Here's another quote. Lynching was a form of racial terrorism that has contributed to a legacy of racial inequality in the United States that must be addressed. Thousands of people of African descent were killed in violent public acts of racial control and domination, and the perpetrators were never held accountable. I'm pretty sure that's like back in the 1840s and 50s and early 60s. I think this is the year 2018. I think there was a civil war. I think 700,000 Americans died. I think there was an Emancipation Proclamation. I think Kennedy sent the National Guard into Alabama back there in 1962. I think we've had a black president and two black attorney generals and also, you know, black senators and black congressmen to, a number of which, by the way, I would vote for in a heartbeat for President of the United States, by the way. Alan West, Tim Scott, any of those guys. I'd vote for them in a friggin' heartbeat. But this is the United Nations take. Now, so here's another voice, a powerful international voice, who, by the way, is kind of applauding, number one, what's happened in Zimbabwe and Rhodesia, and number two, what is happening literally as I do this show for you in South Africa. So can you see the momentum building here for reparations of some type? By the way, there's now a coalition of Caribbean nations, kind of prompted by this UN deal, that are clamoring for reparations from, quote-unquote, the colonial powers, France, the Dutch, Denmark, down the Caribbean islands. They think that they're entitled to reparations because these colonial powers have so oppressed them over the years. Now, I don't know the history of the Caribbean folks, but I'm pretty sure it's not one of rampant slavery. Well, let's flash forward, Marvin, shall we? Because I'm still answering your question. And it was also a segment I was going to do, so your email was absolutely spot on. Thank you for sending it. And by the way, any and all of you who want to comment on the website, send an email or whatever, please do. Please do. Just this last week, here in the United States of America, land of the free, home of the brave, with a constitutional foundation, there was a huge confab, shall we say, confab. A wealthy Democratic donor club, we'll call it. And they got together to discuss the future of the, what they call liberal, it's the progressive movement. And as part of their platform, folks, this is mainstream Democratic Party, which now is kind of alt left. They agreed that they would be fighting for reparations, I'm not making this up, in the United States by 2022. I quote, "It's 2022 and we are celebrating policy victories across the nation, Medicare for all, and free college, and next on the agenda is reparations. Take a ride in our time machine to hear from the true political geniuses who will make this happen." Let me tell you a little bit more about what this group says. This isn't a flash in the pan, and this is a group that is comprised of many, many groups, with hundreds of thousands of members and millions of devotees around the United States. Alt-left? You bet. Democratic Party? You bet. Is the Democratic Party the alt-left? You bet. Are they willing to take your property to get their votes? You bet. Does it have anything to do with racial inequality? No. Does it have everything to do with economic inequality? Yes. The group is called the Democracy Alliance, and their conference was held this week, this past week, in the year 2018, in the country United States of America, in Atlanta. All sorts of people, including elected representatives, were at this confab, folks. This wasn't some string of left-wingers you've never heard about, who just came out of a college campus. For instance, Maxine Waters. Gee, where have we heard that name before? Tom Perez, chairman of the DNC. Gee, where have we heard that name before? Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Gee, wasn't he the guy who gave $700,000 to McCabe's wife? Oh, yeah, he was, huh? Representatives Paul Grijalva from Arizona. Mark Pocan from Wisconsin, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. The invitation to this confab read, "The group further predicts that this successful implementation of universal health care and free college will lead to sweeping election victories, including the governorship in Texas and its electoral votes in the 2024 presidential election. Because we will be governing with gusto, we're seeing victories up and down the ballot, including winning a governorship in Texas and putting 38 electoral votes in grasp by 2024. Stop in 2020 and 2019 when local power builders turned Arizona and Florida solidly blue and established Virginia as a progressive governance juggernaut." Unquote. The Democratic Alliance, folks, is the biggest, wealthiest donor club in the Democratic Party. This is not some little adjunct now. And to give you an idea, as part of this group, there's a bunch of other very well-heeled donor and activist groups. Remember, this is all under the Democratic Party. The same DNC who committed election fraud with Hillary Clinton I was talking about earlier, the same DNC who filed this this lawsuit against Russia, Trump, and, you know, whoever else, that DNC. Oh, by the way, Keith Ellison was at this deal too. one of the outfits that's in with them, in other words, under this umbrella, is called the Solidaire Network. That's another group of wealthy liberal donors. And that particular group loves protests. They love direct action. The Solidaire group, just so you know, is one of the main groups that finances the resistance, and some of its money comes from Soros. Huh, imagine that. And the MO, shall we say, of that group, their mission statement, is to combat immediate threats to immigrants, women, Muslim and Arab American communities, black people, LGBTQ communities, and all people of color, and to push back against Republicans. Then there's another outfit, the Center for Popular Democracy. They're based in New York, by the way. And they're also a progressive advocacy group. They put together $60 million in financing for anti-Trump networks. Popular Democracy Action Fund. By the way, Keith Ellison is the deputy chairman of the Democratic National Committee, folks. So you had both the chairman of the National Committee, Perez, and the deputy chairman, Ellison, at this event. And this event clearly said in its platforms that this is an event to divide by race and color, to divide by other divisive demarcations, shall we say, of social fabric, and to get to where everybody has free health care. Gee, who's going to pay for that? And everybody has free college. And building on those with a bigger voter base, then they're going to go to reparations. I mean, it's right there. I believe this article is posted. All these articles on reparations are posted on the Constitution or Family Safety, by the way. The ones on the lawsuits and all that kind of stuff are posted under treason, which is where they belong. Let me quote, "This national network, led by working class people of color and immigrants, will supply the power and the fight we need to resist the Trump administration's all-out assault on American values." This is Keith Ellison speaking, by the way, at this convention. The second in command of the DNC. And I might add a Muslim, and I might add a black. "I look forward to standing with the CPD Action's leaders in the streets and in Congress to win real progressive change." The Center for Popular Democracy, by the way, also has partnerships with more than 50 other left-wing outfits, folks. So this is not some fringe group. This is like the nucleus of the Democratic Party / progressive fundraising machine. And they are jumping up and down, in their own words, for free health care, free college, and reparations, including forgiveness of debt. Please, Google it yourself. Just type in reparations in your search bar, and you'll read a whole bunch of scary stuff. This is very real. Very real. And the way you stop this kind of stuff, besides sending, go to the politics section on the website. I've posted several pleas for campaign dollars. And send those candidates 10 or 20 or 30 bucks. That's one way you can get involved. The second way you can get involved is beating nicely on the heads with emails and phone calls on your current elected representatives. And the third way you can be involved is make damn sure that the Second Amendment stays intact and the First Amendment stays intact. Because without those things, folks, without those two amendments, without the ability to speak your mind and the ability to defend your right to speak your mind, life might get very unpleasant. Particularly when these people are, I mean, they're now bold enough to be out of the closet and actually say this stuff. Once again, Trump has drawn these cuckoos out of the closet. All right, I'm going to speak very briefly now on this outrageous breach of security. God only knows how many people have died because of this. Once again, from the Democratic side, because they don't care, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who, by the way, should be indicted. Hopefully her name will be rolling out for criminal referral also. These Pakistani IT specialists who were given unfettered access with no background checks whatsoever to the most sensitive and secret information in the heart of the servers of 44 Democratic congressmen and senators, including senators and congressmen on the Ways and Means, Judicial and Intelligence Committees, you know, top secret stuff. And who were allowed to continue to access those servers even after February of 2017 when the IG brought his report that they were doing exactly what they were doing. And who were paid $5 million of our taxpayers' money by these 44 kook Democrats led by Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And who will not comment on the case but hired private attorneys so that law enforcement could not get in to determine, could not get into the computers to determine exactly what had been stolen. We now find out that basically the entire server, which at one point was physically stolen by these folks, physically stolen, the server. We're not talking about the information server, we're talking about the whole server. That it was all downloaded into a USB and given to Pakistani intelligence. And the only crime that the FBI, under Comey, has yet to bring, the only charge is for money laundering and bank fraud. The FBI, under Comey, and so far under Wray, has not even investigated the espionage part of this. You know why, right? Because that's going to implicate these 44 Democratic congressmen and senators. I mean, it stinks like a dead fish rotting in a week-long hot sun. I'm going to be keeping you abreast of this. There's one reporter who's doing just a tremendous, tremendous job on it. His name is, by the way, Luke Rosiak. Luke Rosiak. His co-writer is Wajid Ali Sayed. I believe that this article is also posted under treason, and you can read it. Because it is... I'm probably going to talk more about it next week. I just want to bring it to your attention. What I really want to do right now is I want to end the show with the final segment, which is some very equally scary stuff. You know, I wish I had some good stuff to tell you. And, you know, there's a lot of human interest stories which are out there which are good stuff. And I will tell you before I get into this not-so-good stuff, with these tech giants screwing with our liberties and our thoughts and our information. Barbara Bush. You know, Barbara Bush, I think, was a great lady. Oh, I'm sure she was tough and she was powerful and she was political. But this woman, if you study her life, devoted really her life to helping other people. She was a very active, very gracious, very caring person to all sorts of minorities, true victims, children, you name it, throughout her, and I'm going to call it a career. You realize that as the wife of a vice president, the wife of a president, the mother of another president, the mother of a governor, She was in the thick and thin of the highest levels of the United States government for 24 years. 24 years. That's really a long time. And through all of it, other than the haters on the left, you should see some of the stuff that was posted. People came to regard her and understand her for what she was, which is a bright, smart, tough, but very kind and very friendly and very caring woman. And she did a lot of good for a lot of people, folks. And she will be missed. She will be missed. And you know, she was married to George Sr. Bush, who I think was a good man and a World War II vet. You know, he's part of the Greatest Generation and a hero. And they were married for 77 years. That in and of itself is an example to the American public. And I'm sure that he misses her terribly. And he's not in good health himself. I think he's 96 or 97. In any event, Godspeed to Barbara Bush. She was the example of a great woman. And maybe some of those gals running around in their hats in the Women's March, maybe they ought to read her biography. Okay. Let's talk about Google. Google Chrome. Yahoo. AOL. Oh, boy. So Google Chrome, with their new user agreement, which you sign whether you know it or not, folks. If you download Google Chrome, you have signed that agreement. Good luck, and I feel for you. They are, Google Chrome is reading anything and everything in your computer. Let me repeat that. Your pictures, your texts, your emails, your documents. If it's on that computer, Google Chrome is scanning it and storing it. And there's not a whole lot you can do about it. In fact, one of the tools that you download with Google Chrome, it's come to light just in the last week, is called the Google Cleanup Tool, which became a mandatory part of Google Chrome in 2017. Great. And by the way, new users and old users were never made aware of this feature, folks. Zero, nada, whatsoever. And the Google Cleanup Tool is, yes, it is. It is the cleanup tool. It cleans up all your information and takes it and stores it without your knowledge and without your permission. It has the ability, through the tool, to scan, that is, scan and record, like turn into a PDF, all, let me underline that, all, capitalize it, all, A-L-L, the files on Windows computers. I was not able to find, although I looked, as to how it works on Apple computers. I imagine perhaps maybe it's a little bit thwarted, but not by much. I don't know. I really don't know. Amazon Echo and Alexa also changed their use agreements and added features supposedly to keep you safe and to make your browsing easier and faster and blah, 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 so that we can provide better services to you. I mean, they all use the same crap. Well, Amazon and Alexa, folks, Amazon Echo and Alexa, to be exact, can do the same thing and are doing the same thing as Google Chrome. Now, if you trust Amazon, if you trust any of these outfits, you're crazy. Amazon, in fact, it came out today. In fact, I listened to Rush Limbaugh for about 45 minutes today. He had a really good show. And a caller called in and said, you know, I just tried, I read Comey's book. I thought it was just terrible. And I tried to post a 2-star review. And Amazon wouldn't let me post the review. And I think the only reviews that are up are 4- and 5-star reviews of Comey's book. And that's impossible. There's like virtually no book written on the planet Earth that doesn't have a 1- or 2-star review. So I think they're blocking it. So Rush actually put his producer on it, Mr. Schnerdley, while all the listeners, including myself, were listening, and this other guy was on the line, and they tried to put in a 3-star review. Nope, wouldn't get it. In fact, they got an email from Amazon saying that due to peculiarities in the reviews for this product, you may be violating the terms of service by posting your review and check blah, 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 this link. The bottom line is Amazon is making damn sure there's no bad reviews of Comey's book. I want you to think about that for a moment. You other authors out there who may be listening to me, I want you to think about that for a moment. It's kind of like the New York Times ignoring certain books that ought to be number one New York Times bestsellers because they just don't like the politics of the book. You know, it is the left doing what it does, which is to smother truth, omit facts, deny, never admit, divert, and control. That's what the left does, folks. That's what they do. So that's Google Chrome. You know, Big Brother is here. It is here. There was a guy by the name of Dylan Curran. Let me tell you a little bit more about this. He's a web developer, very well known and excellent in Ireland. He downloaded his own Google file, and in a series of tweets, he revealed that Google has been holding on to his data, all of it, since 2008, and that just his data, a decade of his data, nobody else's, was 5.5 gigabytes, which is the equivalent of 3 million Word docs. Think about that for a moment, if you will. Amazon's Alexa. There's been stories about Alexa spying on people through TVs, through cameras, through all sorts of stuff. And I want you to know that Amazon just in the last month filed a patent request for what's called a voice sniffer algorithm. A voice sniffer algorithm. This would allow Alexa to listen to your household conversations in real time. Think about this now. To listen to your household conversations in real time and identify trigger words in those conversations, which would give Amazon insight into your home, into your life, into your thoughts, into your wants, into your needs. Wow. Now, I don't know about you folks. I've never bought any appliances from Amazon. I don't think I'm going to. I think I'm going to be damn careful where I buy them from anyone. I'm not sure I want my stove listening to me. Okay. By the way, there's several articles on this. You feel free. You can look under the Constitution part of our website for these articles on therightsideradio.com. And several of these articles, for instance, this article on Google has other links in it that you can click on and read more. I mean, this is really scary stuff, at least to me. Maybe all you folks are okay with it. And that's not the only thing going on just in the last week in the tech world. It seems that Yahoo and AOL have insisted or have mandated or have automatically enrolled you in their new use agreements and privacy policies just, I guess, very recently. And Yahoo and AOL, this is hundreds of millions of users, folks. It's called the Oath. That's what it's called, the Oath. By the way, AOL and Yahoo now are pretty much run by Verizon. I don't know if you know that or not, but they are pretty much run by Verizon. And the Oath, this new user policy, if you will, reads your emails, your instant messages, your posts, your photos, and your message attachments. That also includes, by the way, just so you know, all your banking and other financial transactions. Great. And Oath is programmed to share any and all information upon request with Verizon, the parent company. How does that make you feel? Make you feel good? Not me. Listen to this. With Oath, you know, Verizon's pretty clever. You might be surprised to learn that the company can capture your data and trace you even when you are not signed into any Oath-related accounts. I'm not making this up, folks. You can read the article for yourself and you can follow the other links. Oath can, I quote, recognize you or your devices even if you are not signed in to our services. Oath may use device IDs, cookies, and other signals, including information obtained from third parties, to associate accounts and or devices with you. This allows us to deliver, personalize, and develop relevant features, content, advertising, and services, unquote. Look it up, folks. Dial up Oath privacy terms statement. Please do. I mean, I wish I was making this up. I wish I was telling you part, the last terrible part of a horrible horror novel, but I'm not. This is the same thing on Yahoo, by the way. And, you know, all these outfits, Google, AOL, Yahoo, say that this also helps them have better ad targeting. Yeah, okay. You'll love this. So this agreement that you didn't know existed, giving all these outfits capabilities you didn't know they had, to take your information which you've never agreed to, without your knowledge, also have clauses in them, you're going to love this, that require mutual arbitration and limit class action lawsuits. So bottom line is, if you don't like these outfits taking your data, and you don't like what they do with your data, good luck trying to sue them. There's an outfit called CNET, which is kind of a watchdog, and they sent a question in writing to Verizon, AOL, and Yahoo. And they wanted to know about the new privacy policy, et cetera, et cetera. And they got an email back that said, quote, "The launch of a unified Oath privacy policy and terms of service is a key stepping stone toward creating what's next for our consumers, while empowering them with transparency and controls over how and when their data is used," unquote. I don't think so. Nice try of the diversion. Let's see, that sentence was great. They denied, and they diverted all in four lines. Maybe Saul Alinsky works for these companies. I don't know. But anyway, a word to the wise, folks. Privacy, if you are online, and with certain of these programs, apparently, whether it's your appliances, your TV, or who knows what, privacy does not exist. It's gone. And I will renew, if you listen to last week's show, Congress needs to pass a law that everybody owns their own data and nobody can use it without their permission or without payment to them. In return, all these outfits can charge for, you know, Google can charge $10 a month for access to Google. I mean, whatever. Or these outfits need to be broken up. Because I'm here to tell you that taking everybody's information off their computers, from their home, when they're standing next to their stove, when they're sitting in front of their TV, that is like, that's a no-no in my world. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Give some money to those candidates. Look at the politics section of the articles. Keep your eyes and ears open. And think outside the box, folks. Do not get caught in the stale atmosphere of normalcy. The times we live in are anything but normal. And unfortunately, the people that we are dealing with, even though a minority, are anything but normal. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.